find your way to a seat. Let's take a minute, LifePoint, and just say thank you and welcome to all of our guests who are here today for baby dedication. There's a bunch of folks who are here. We're grateful for you being here. We've been in this series all summer called A New Selfie, where we've been looking at the book of Galatians. And really the core verse that we've talked about from Galatians throughout the summer, we've been memorizing it together, is Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. It says this: "My old self has been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. So I live in this earthly body by trusting in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me." So throughout the book, Paul has been arguing with us and with the Galatians for this matter of the gospel. And remember that it's kind of Paul on one side, and then he's got a group of critics called the Judaizers on the other side. And Paul is making his case for salvation by grace. The Judaizers are really making their case for salvation by religion or by kind of a system of rules. So in the middle of those two, there's one thing that the two sides, that they both agree on, and it's this: that we were all born flawed, we're all born imperfect, that we all have a sense of brokenness about our lives. I know one of the things, whenever you come to a service on Sundays, and you know that there's, you know, already been a service at 9:30, for example, and we had other baby dedications that you didn't get to, you know, see and experience those families. So I've got a picture up here I thought I would show you of one of the babies from the other baby dedication. You know what that is right there? That's a little sinner. That's exactly what that is right there. That's what Paul and the Judaizers both agreed, that we are born in this world into sin. From the cradle to the casket, we are imperfect, broken, flawed people. But the question then becomes, if we are wrong, how do we become right? And this group of critics, these Judaizers, said, well, the way you become right is by doing right things, by keeping the rules, by offering to God this this exquisite moral report card, kind of like you've got to, you know, keep a 3.5 GPA morally in front of God, and if you do that, then God's going to give you the gold star, and you know, but it's a lot of pressure to maintain that, right? I know what that's like. Whenever I was in seminary, Angie and I were in seminary at the same time. Angie had a 4.0 GPA, perfect GPA in seminary, and I had a 2.0 in seminary, and so I know what the pressure of that is like. What Paul would say to the Judaizers is, listen, it's not on our shoulders to keep that perfect moral GPA average. Rather, when we couldn't do that, what happened is that Jesus Christ left heaven, came to earth, and he was perfect in our place, where we are all flawed and broken, and we all have sin, and we have guilt, and we have remorse and regret and all those things. Jesus came and lived a perfect life. He's the one who could offer God that perfect report card in our place, so that what happens is that we receive this salvation freely from him. Now, as we get into chapter 5 today, what Paul is going to begin to talk about with us is this idea of biblical freedom. He's going to say three things about freedom to us today. Number one, he's going to talk to us about what we think freedom is. And then number two, he's going to talk to us about what freedom really is. And then finally, he's going to talk about what freedom does. So, if you got a copy of the scriptures, turn over to Galatians chapter 5, and we will start reading in verse 13. "For you were called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another." Now, what we think freedom is in our culture, for the most part, is that we think freedom is independence without injury. We kind of have two views, really, in our culture of freedom, but maybe the one that's most predominant, maybe a more liberal view of freedom, is its independence without injury. In other words, I can do whatever it is that I want to do as long as I don't hurt anybody else. That I'm a self-determined Columbusite. I can do whatever I want as long as I don't do harm or hurt anybody else. Now, I don't have a lot of time to spend on this, but let's talk about that just quickly. So that idea, if we say that, listen, I'm free to do whatever I want to do, that means that I have no accountability, right? Nod your heads at me like you're listening. It helps me when you do, right? If I say that I'm free, no accountability. Well, the problem with that is, who determines what harm is? Who determines what hurt is? If you say, you know what, I'm a free agent, I'm going to smoke crack because I want to smoke crack. I say, wait a minute, that's harmful. That hurts society at large. It has an economic effect on society. It certainly has a personal effect on the potential of impacting others, others who are younger than you, maybe influencing them in the same direction. And I would say probably it does hurt people. Probably hurts your parents. If you're a parent, it certainly hurts your children. There's a lot of people that it hurts. Now, the problem all of a sudden becomes then you cannot smoke crack and not hurt anyone, right? If I say, no, that hurts me, there's an either or, not a both and there. So what you realize is that that system breaks down because who determines what hurt is or what harm is? And what Paul says in verse 13 that we read in chapter 5 is that we have to be careful that we don't use freedom as an opportunity to indulge our flesh. In other words, to do only what it is that we want to do. Now, that's the liberal perspective. Now, then there's a conservative perspective on freedom that says, no, wait. There is a God, and you better pay attention to him, because if you don't, he's going to get you. See, the conservative side of things, really, it's really kind of pushed our culture in the direction to say that Christianity is anything but freedom. Our culture in a lot of ways views Christianity when it comes to this idea of freedom is that when you become a Christian, you step inside of this really, really small box. And inside of this box, you don't really have a lot of movement, and there's certainly not a lot of fun inside of this box because there's all of these parameters. What Paul would say to us is, listen, be careful. Because God has given you guidelines, parameters, number one, for your good. Number two, if you're not careful when you adopt this view, what you're going to do is you're going to end up trying to kind of live like this. You're going to kind of try and live a little bit Christian when you're around Christian people and a little bit not so Christian when you're not around Christian people. And the moment you step outside of God's parameters, you're going to welcome some sort of pain into your life. For some of us, we think about this idea of Christian freedom, and what we want to do is we want to live as absolutely close to this edge as we can without stepping outside the boundaries, which ends up doing what? It ends up just blurring the lines, and we end up crossing them consistently. What Paul would argue for is that there's a lot more freedom in here than you really understand. I think the older that I get, one of the things that I realize about Christianity is that inside of God's parameters, there's room. There's room for all different kinds of people, all different kinds of personalities that God has created. Christianity is not this small, narrow focus that the Judaizers would have us believe that says you've got to be this kind of person, you've got to dress this kind of way, you've got to act this kind. There's freedom for all different kinds of personalities. My family and I had the opportunity this summer to go to Cedar Point. You don't have to go any farther than Cedar Point to realize there are all different kinds of people in this world, right? Actually, one of the things I learned about Cedar Point is there's only two kinds of people. There are only two kinds of people who go to Cedar Point. One group of people are the people who make out in line while they're waiting to get on the rides. And then there's people who want to vomit because they have to watch the people make out in lines while, you know, they're waiting on the rides. And it just amazing, you know, people look up, oh, we have 45 minutes before, you know, we get on the rafter. And all of a sudden, it's like this, you know. It's like, oh, man, we have time, you know. And so, you know, I guess Angie and I really embarrassed the kids while we were there. Yeah. I know some of you thought about Happy Days when I did that, didn't you? Some of you were thinking Happy Days. It's all different kinds of people, and there's room for a breadth of expression in the body. And Paul says, listen, that's what freedom is. Don't think what you think freedom is, this old idea of independence without injury, that argument breaks down. Well, Paul, if that's the case, then what is freedom? That brings us to the next verse, to verse 14. It says this, "For the whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Paul says real freedom is found in love. He appeals to the golden rule. And what Paul says here is that you're going to see an expression of the love of God and the freedom in your life. How? In how you deal with other people. See, this whole idea of freedom, it's a much bigger deal. And honestly, we don't talk about it enough. Think about Jesus' ministry. The first message that Jesus ever stands up to deliver, Luke chapter 4. He says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, and he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor and freedom to the captives." It's almost like Jesus, you know, he hasn't even really finished his first sentence of his first message. It's almost like he's saying, this whole idea of freedom is just going to be smothered over everything I do. And what Paul is saying is you can see the freedom or lack thereof in our lives by the way that we love other people. Real freedom is found in love. Love is the starting blocks for freedom. So how does that show up in relationships? Paul says in the next verse, "But if you bite and devour one another, watch out that you are not consumed by each other." See, what Paul is pushing us towards is this idea that you and I, we don't even know what the real desires of our heart are. That oftentimes we think we know what we want, but really the desires, the deepest desires of our hearts are in conflict with each other. It shows up in numerous ways, over and over and over and over again in our lives. It shows up. For example, we love Krispy Kreme donuts, right? You drive down Polaris Parkway, the hot donut sign is on, and you go and you buy a whole dozen Krispy Kreme donuts. And what do you want to do? Well, you want to eat the whole box, right? Now, what happens when you eat a whole box of Krispy Kreme donuts? You are very, very happy, aren't you? Aren't you really happy? At the same time, you don't want to have, you know, clogged arteries when you kind of get up there around midlife, so you're kind of caught. On the one hand, if you don't eat all the Krispy Kreme donuts that you want to eat, you have unfulfilled desire. And in the Western mindset, that is not allowable, right? That's just crazy that we wouldn't fulfill a desire that we have. At the same time, if you eat a dozen Krispy Kreme donuts, then you've got all this kind of guilt and fear. And that's just one way that Paul says, listen, you don't even know what you really want. Your hearts, the desires that you have inside of your heart, in a simple way like donuts and how you eat, but in much deeper ways, your heart is in conflict with itself. So what does that mean? I think it means this. It means that freedom is not about doing what I truly want to do. Rather, it's about truly wanting whatever it is that I do. And I'm going to say that to you again. Freedom is not about doing whatever I truly want to do. It's more about truly wanting whatever it is that I do. See, Paul says, listen, you are free. You receive grace from God and you are free. And we think that means, well, I get whatever I want. Think about freedom in this way. You know, none of us ever goes over to Alum Creek Lake, across the bridge, maybe at the dam on the south side or across Cheshire Road, and stands up there and looks at Alum Creek Lake and says, "Oh, those poor fish. They're so confined by the boundaries of the lake out there." We don't look at fish that way, right? Poor fish all the time, knocking up against the bank. They're constrained. No, we don't think that. We think, man, those fish in that water, they're free. They can do whatever they want to. They can drink, right? Little fishy, you're never going to drink all the water in Alum Creek Lake. But let's say one of those little fish, you know, gets up against the side one day and says, "You know what? I'm tired of water. I want to try land." And so flops out over onto the bank. Is the fish free? No, he's dead, right? Right? So what's Paul getting at here? Here's the idea. You and I are free to become everything we were designed to become. We were created with the image of God, and we are free to flourish in the image of God. I would say to this degree, we're like little fish in Alum Creek Lake. Drink, drink, drink deeply of the grace of God. You'll never drink it all up. See, when you think about this box, I think what Paul would say is, hey, there's a lot of room in here. This box is much bigger than you think it is, than you realize that it is. You think about this box in terms of marriage or our homes. You know, our marriages look different. Our relationships look different. As long as we're inside the parameters and the guidelines of what God has created, one man, one woman, strong bond forever, we have freedom in that. Now, whenever it comes to your relationship with your spouse, the moment that you do this, you're welcoming pain. God has given us guidelines and parameters around our relationships for our good. You think about something like the educational choices that we make in the context of a family. There's a lot of room in here. You know, on the one end of the spectrum, some people send their kids to public school and they say, man, I can't believe people would homeschool their kids. That's going to hurt their social skills. And man, we need light over here in the public schools. And I can't believe somebody would homeschool their children. And people who homeschool their kids say, I can't believe somebody would send their kids to public school and be influenced in this way and that way and allow this and that and the other. And in the middle, some people send their kids to Christian school, and kind of on both sides, they're like, well, you're just kind of allowing your kids to grow up in this little bubble that really doesn't exist out in the real world. And there's all this criticism. Well, you know, just, is it homeschool? Is it public school? Is it private? Is it Christian? Is it what? So which one's right? Whichever one you pray about and your family says is right for you. It's not that there's a right or a wrong. There's freedom. Inside the boundaries of what God is doing and what God has created for you and your family, none of those three is right or wrong. It's which one of those things is right for you. See, Paul says when it comes to this issue of freedom, there's a whole lot more here than what you may think. One of my favorite teachers quotes a French novelist, kind of philosopher. Her name was Françoise Sagan. And when she was older, because freedom had been a theme of her writings and of some of her novels, she was interviewed and she was asked the question, the freedom that you wrote about, the freedom that you obviously wanted that was a theme for you, did you ever find it? Did you ever really have freedom? And I want to read her answer to that question. Here's what she said. Well, yes and no. No, I was not free while I was in love, but fortunately, one's not in love all the time. So apart from when I was in love, then yes, I was free. You see what Sagan is saying there? She brings up an issue, and I think rightly so, that independence, freedom, and love in human relationships are kind of at odds with each other. For example, whenever you get married, you realize that no longer can you get off work and go do whatever it is that you want to do. You call your spouse and you say, hey, here's what I'm thinking. What's your calendar say? What are you into? Because I'd like to go hang out with the guys. I'd like to. See, love is a restriction to freedom. The only way that would work is if there was somebody who knew your every need and who met your every need exactly when you needed it. And you and I both know that because of our flaws and because of our brokenness, that person doesn't exist. So that pushes Paul to another thought. Whatever it is that you seek, whatever it is that you pursue more than anything else will ultimately control you. I didn't put that in your notes, but if you're taking notes, jot notes, I want you to write that down. Whatever it is that you ultimately seek is going to be the thing that controls you. If for you it's power, and you say, man, my number one goal is power, as much as you seek power, power will then, whether you have a lot of it or don't have enough of it, that's what's going to control your emotions. If it's finances, the amount that you have stored up, laid up, that you are earning or not earning in your mind compared against what you want is going to control your emotions. If it's acceptance from other people, if it's the praise of other people, then you're going to be good whenever your relationships are be good. And whenever your relationships are not good, that's going to affect you emotionally. If you say, you know what, there's a person out there that I want to date, and you ultimately pursue them as the greatest goal of your life, your emotions are going to be up and down on a roller coaster, whether or not that person feels good about you or doesn't feel good about you. Whatever you seek ultimately becomes God in your life. If there's anything in your life that you say, you know what, if I just had that, then I would be happy. That's going to be the thing that controls you. And Sagan just proves what Paul says, that the independence and love are kind of at odds with each other unless there was a person who could meet exactly what the need of your heart was, exactly when you needed it. And we know that person doesn't exist. Or does that person exist? Because here's what Paul says in verse 18. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Paul said, if the Spirit of God is primary in your life, what happens is you are not subject to the law. And if you're not subject to the law, then what? Then you're not subject to the guilt of breaking the law. And then all of a sudden you're able to live in this life. You're able to experience freedom. How so? Because you're in relationship with the only person in the universe who can give you exactly what you need at exactly the moment you need it. And how you and I respond to the love that God has shown us, to the grace that he has given to us, is absolutely critical. You know, there's a word in the Old Testament. It's not a word that we use a lot anymore, but it's kind of one of those that describes pretty well in the Old Testament how people responded to God. And it's the word to consecrate. Consecrate is two Hebrew words that they smush together to kind of make one word. The first part of that word is mal, and the second part is yad. And mal means to fill up. Mal means open hands. And yad means to fill up. So when you smush those two things together, they mean to fill up the open hand. So in the Old Testament, so many times right before God was going to do something big, something amazing, he would speak to the king or to the prophet, and he would say to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow I'm going to do great, mighty wonders among you that you do not know. That's Joshua 3:5, before the people are going to go into the promised land the next day. And so over and over and over again, God calls people in the Old Testament to consecrate themselves. And the picture is that there's a priest that has his hands open and empty. And whenever you consecrate yourself, you bring your sacrifice, your offering, and you fill up the open hands of the priest. And so that when you make your sacrifice, you're consecrated. You're set apart. Well, the reason whenever the scriptures were translated into English that they chose the word consecrate to attach to this Hebrew concept of filling up the open hands is a little bit different. See, in the medieval centuries, kings had this event called the homage ceremony. Have you ever wondered, if I were to say to you right now, take the posture of prayer, what would you do? If I were to ask you, what does it look like typically when somebody prays? What do you think about physically? I think most of us would go like that, right? Or we'd put our hands like that. Why do we do that? You ever wonder why we do that? If somebody says, I'm going to pray, and they do this, we don't think anything about that, do we? We think about prayer. We think about kneeling and putting our hands together. You ever wonder why we do that? I mean, that's not the posture that we see in the Hebrew world. You see priests praying at the wailing wall. They're standing praying. They're putting pieces of paper in the wailing wall. They stand. That's not a Hebrew concept. Where did this idea come from? It came from the medieval centuries in Western Europe from this event called the homage ceremony. What kings would do is they would invite all of their subjects together, all their vassals, call them all together. And at this homage ceremony, what people would do is that they would come in front of the king. They would take their hands like this, put them together. They would kneel down in front of the king, and they would put their hands in the king's hands. As a matter of fact, I think I've got a sketch drawing of it up here that I'll show you. You see how the vassal there, the subject, has knelt down in front of the king. He's got his hands together, and he puts them in the king's open hands, and the king wraps his hands around the subject's hands. And what would happen in the homage ceremony is that the king, in taking the subject's hands, the subject was saying to the king, "I'm yours." As a matter of fact, they would say, subject would say out loud, "I'm your man," or "I'm your woman," as a way of saying to the king, "Everything I am, everything I have is yours. It all belongs to you." Well, after this homage ceremony grew in popularity, Christians began to say, you know what? We owe a greater allegiance. We have a higher authority than our earthly king. And so when Christians started to think about how can we show that, how can we display that, when they prayed publicly, they started praying with their hands together, and they would kneel down on one knee or on two knees as a way of saying, we are giving homage to a greater king. We are putting our lives, our hands in his hands and saying to him, to the ultimate king, "I'm your man," or "I'm your woman." So I wonder what it would be like for you and me as we approach a new week to adopt a different posture in prayer. That as we go to God, whether that's at a dinner table or that's in a closet that you pray in the morning, or that's in a big chair you pray in, I don't know where it is that you pray, that you would pray with this attitude. Begin by saying, "God, this is homage to you." That you would say to him, "Okay, God, before I start to ask, before I start to request anything, I want to say that I'm your man, that I'm your woman." You see, that's got to be the heart of our approach, because from the cradle to the casket, we're all broken and we're all flawed. And outside of God, we don't have any hope. We can't offer God this perfect moral report card. Since the Garden of Eden, a place where Adam and Eve had all of the freedom you could imagine in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve chose to step outside of God's parameters. And when they did that, they brought sin into the world. Not just to all the world, but into our lives personally. And what God says to Eve in that moment, in that conversation, after they sin, is God says to Eve, "Your seed is going to bruise the serpent's head." Now, what does that mean? That meant from out of Eve's line, eventually was going to come a Savior. He had to come because of our sin and because of our brokenness. As a matter of fact, we look up at God and say, "God, this is all I've got. It's broken, it's imperfect, and I know that it's not good enough. It doesn't meet your righteous standard." And it kind of leaves all of us in the spot of saying, who do we have? Who can represent us to God? And at just the right moment in eternal history, the scriptures say that Jesus left heaven and came to earth, and in essence, Jesus said, "I'm your man." And he represented us perfectly in his life. He never did anything wrong. And I don't mean that he just never made a mistake. I want you to think about that from the motivations of his heart to his attitudes to the way he treated others. He did it perfectly. Not just that he was perfect in his life, but then he was perfect in his death. He offered himself as a sacrifice for our sins, and not just perfect in his death, but then perfect in his resurrection and being raised from the dead, so that he beat death in our place. Why did he do that? Galatians chapter 5, verse 1 says, it was for freedom that you have been set free. It doesn't say it was for religion that you have been set free. Jesus set us free inside the context and the parameters of everything that God has designed for us, dreamed for us, wished for us, all of the nuances of your personality and my personality. We are free in him. So listen to me. Drink deeply of the grace of God, and you'll never drink enough. How does that work in our lives consistently? It works when we, on a daily basis, bring our lives in front of him. And on Monday morning, with all of its challenges, with all the clocks ticking, all the racing, when we take time to come in front of him and say to him, I'm your man. I'm your woman. Let's pray together.